Okay, I've got 5 o'clock. I'm going to get started. I know a few more people will be trickling in, and that'll be good. But I want to go ahead and get started. Luke and I have kept we've had to keep switching the schedule up, and I think originally he was going to teach this class, but I'm actually really happy to be teaching it. This is one of my favorite stories in the Bible, for some reasons we'll get into a little bit later, but I hope that by the time we finish, you will also see it as a really good story with a lot of really useful applications for us, especially in the area of edifying and encouraging one another and our fellowship with one another, how that kind of looks in a boots on the ground way, as we sometimes say in business. We're going to talk about this chapter tonight, and I hope that it will be useful to you. Our objectives for tonight are be able to explain why the Transjordan tribes built the altar, and then also explain why Israel objected to it. To be able to list the three realities of obedience that are illustrated in Joshua 28. Turk had that realities of obedience. You can call it whatever you want, but there are, I think, three things to keep in mind that this chapter illustrates for us. And to be able to name at least three scriptural principles for dealing with what I'm going to call offensive altars in our relationships with other people. So if you can do those at the end, we will have succeeded. Let's go through the chapter looking for our themes, as we've been doing. Where did you find the theme of every place the sole of your foot treads I've given to you?
Mace, would
I wrote down there were a couple of places.
Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
No, go ahead, Dave.
Okay, I wrote down there were a couple of places that referred to the land of your possession. I think verse 4, verse 9, those phrases seem to indicate that they've been given.
Yep, exactly. Yeah, I had all of those. Very good. Teresa, what were you going to say?
I was going to ask you about Numbers 22. That it seemed more like a repeat of Numbers 22. So I'm not sure how that fits in.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what point you're making about Numbers 22.
Well, I had it under, in Numbers 22, the Reuben and Gad were promised, or Moses was going to give them a certain amount of land if they went to war and did all that. And help their brethren. So it just seemed like it was a recount of what was going on in Numbers 22.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that will come up when we get to being careful to obey the law. I think if you want to, I think that probably fits there. The other one that I came up with is in verse 11. This is a small thing, but it says on the side belonging to the sons of Israel. It seems like based on Judges that land hadn't been fully conquered yet, and there's some debate about which side of the river they built this altar on, which I'm not really going to get into. But in whichever side they built it on land that essentially belongs to them, which I think highlights this theme. What about no one will be able to stand before you? We're at the end of the conquest, at least the conquest as recorded in Joshua. But do you see this theme in these chapters? Maybe just as a kind of background for something?
I kind of thought there was an implication in the phrase in verse 4, the Lord your God has given rest.
Yep, exactly.
To your brethren.
Yeah, exactly. That no one has been able to stand on and rest. There's another interesting one to skip all the way to the end of the chapter, where after this conflict that we'll talk about has been resolved, in verse 33, the sons of Israel blessed God, and they did not speak of going up against them in war to destroy the land in which the sons of Reuben and the sons of Gad were living. Now, maybe I'm reading too much into this verse, but it seems to me like there's an implication in that verse that the 2.5 Transjordan tribes would not be able to stand against the Israelites going out to punish them for their sins, right? That this phrase would also apply. And you can think of Achan or other, you know, people who were disobedient in this period. That verse is it almost sounds like we're glad we don't have to do this because you would have been wiped out. You know, maybe I'm reading too much into that, but I think that would fit with this idea of the person that God sided, the person on whose side God is, will always win. What about be strong and courageous or do hard things? Something that would have required some strength and courage.
I thought maybe verse 30, where you know the congregation of Israel hears the explanation given and actually, you know, considers it and goes with it. It's kind of embarrassing that they marched their entire, you know, people over there to come up with something and it wasn't the same thing. Maybe not embarrassing is not the good word, but the idea that they heard the explanation and went with it.
Maybe even harder turn the army around is being that your snap assessment of the situation was not correct, right? And how many of us find it hard to do that? I've come to a conclusion in 2.5 seconds, and I've decided that's the reality of the world, and nothing will ever change my mind, you know. And Phineas and the 10 representatives say, oh, okay, good. I'm glad I was wrong. Let's go home. That's really good. I didn't put that one down, but that certainly was a hard thing to do.
Maybe harder is to take action against your brethren when it's needed.
Yep.
At some point, mistaken, though, yep. It was probably a hard thing to now later in the time,
yes.
You'd always be squabbling, you know, but between tribes. But here, they've just finished this great victory, and you hate to cause trouble.
Yep. Yeah, so I picked verses 12 to 15 to kind of represent that point where they hear about it, they gather together, they send their representatives to go talk to them. That's a hard thing to do, and they are to be commended for doing it. What about be careful to do according to all the law? I found a lot in this category. I'm sure I missed some, but I think there are a lot of choices here.
They were able to recount the Peor incident, which is in the Law of Moses, so to speak, technically in the first five books, right?
Yes, and also one other incident.
Well, Achan, but it's not in the principles, right. but I was just saying, recalling the revelation of Moses.
Yep. Yep, that's good. I got that one. So there are the land allotments that Moses had made across the Jordan. Those are referenced in the first five verses a couple of times. Verses 16 to 20, the recounting their history and the incidents that we just talked about. Sorry, I couldn't think of that word. Verses 21 to 29, the answer that the tribes give is essentially an answer that says, we want to obey the law. We want to do everything according to the law that God has commanded us. And so then there's one other, which is kind of a couple of places, one at the beginning and one at the end, which is this idea of Israel gathering together to go punish the people who, in their minds, had already gone back into idolatry. So it's in verse 12, they gather together and go across. In verse 33, I've already referenced that verse where they don't speak of going up against them in war to destroy the land. That's actually commanded in Deuteronomy 13, where if people are disobedient and worshiping idols, you punish them. 13:13-16. If you hear in one of your cities which the Lord your God is giving you to live in, anyone saying that some worthless men have gone out from among you and have seduced the inhabitants of their city, saying, let us go and serve other gods, then you shall investigate and search out and inquire thoroughly. They do that. If it is true in the matter established this abomination has been done among you, you shall surely strike the inhabitants of that city with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying it and all that is in it and its cattle with the edge of the sword. So, that's the law, and that's exactly what they do here. They hear about it, they go investigate, and they're ready to execute the judgment or if that is required. And so it looks like civil war, right? Because you're about to have a war between the east and west sides of Israel, but it's really about making sure that God's law is obeyed. Definitely meditate on the law day and night. Yes, go ahead, Janice.
I was just going to say, I think verse 31 could be included. You may be going there. When it says, today we know the Lord is in our midst because you have not committed this unfaithful act against the Lord. And I just saw that as, in other words, you haven't offended the law. You've kept it.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. They had been obedient. It just took a little clarification. Yeah, thank you. That's a good point. So meditating on the law day and night, where do you see that happening or being facilitated in this chapter?
Well, that's kind of the point of the altar they build. Is to remember this over generations and see it all the time and think back. So,
yep. Yeah, very good. What else do you see? Yeah, so I'm sorry, I'll just finish that thought. So that's verse 24 captures that very well. We've done this out of concern for a reason, saying in time to come, your sons may say to our sons, what have you to do with the Lord, the God of Israel? And verses 26 to 29 kind of that we built the altar as a witness between you and us so that we can all remember God's law that we're all brothers and we're all supposed to worship together. So those are the verses that I put to capture the point that Daniel made about the altar being a reminder. What else did you see?
Verse 5, only be very careful to observe the commandments. And the law which Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you. And then it goes on, of course. But that would be...
Right. Yeah.
That's all.
Right. Yeah, so one of the points we've made many times in this class, at which the book of Joshua illustrates very clearly, is that it's really pretty impossible to be careful to do according to all the law if you're not meditating on the law day and night, right? And so often when we see in Joshua people obeying the law, it's because they have meditated on the law. They understand it very well. So I think these two are almost inextricably linked. But so we've already mentioned the stories from Israel's history, the iniquity of Peor, where Balaam tempted them, the Achan story. These are all things that they have clearly been thinking about and thinking about, what does this mean for us? What would it look like, the next time this happens, and how will we deal with that? And so having thought about those things, they're all ready for a situation like this when it's... All right.
Hey, Mace.
Typo there.
Hey, Mace.
Yes.
Before you skip on, I was just saying, it was, they're literally, or at least it appears to be, quoting Deuteronomy 11, chapter 11, verse 18 through 30. It seems like they're literally quoting Deuteronomy in as far as the law is concerned.
So which verses are you in Joshua 22 are you talking about?
In Joshua 5, he's really quoting Deuteronomy 11, chapter 11, verse 18 through 30. About
okay.
keeping the law and
oh,
the
verse
way that
5.
It should be kept. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yep. Yeah, that is true. And that characterizes, really it characterizes the speech of all the faithful people that we have record of. They know God's law so well that they basically speak like the Bible. And I think that's a worthy goal for us to aim for. Okay. I'm going to break us up into groups. And I want us to think about this question. Why do you think this story is recorded in the book? And how would it have benefited the book's original readers? And in that context of the readers of the book, I want you to consider 2 Kings chapter 23, verses 8 and 9, and see if you see any application from this story to the situation that Josiah found himself in that chapter. So I'm going to break us up into, I think, groups of about three. I'm going to do groups of four, actually. It'll be easier. All right, and I'll give you about 90 seconds to this. See what you come up with. Okay, welcome back. So what did you come up with?
I guess a basic answer is to explain why the altar is there and what it was and what it wasn't.
Yeah, right. And what's interesting about that, because I think you're right, that is one of the purposes of the chapter, is that altar is never mentioned again, at least that I could find. It's you would think something that big and that kind of important just would kind of be, you know, mentioned again, but it's not, as far as I can tell. But clearly somebody at some point after the book was written, you know, needed to know why it was there and what it meant, and so we have this story. So how would this story have benefited, you know, people reading the book under the old law? What would it have told them? This is the second part of the question. How would it have benefited the book's readers?
Kind of a healthy example of godly confrontation and resolution of, you know, what is it that we should be doing? Is this good or is this not? And kind of the way it's handled and then resolved. I guess it also kind of highlights how we can tend to jump to assumptions that aren't true, but then highlights how we need to communicate what our intention. There's a lot here about godly confrontation that I think is good.
Yeah, I agree. It's really why it's one of my favorite chapters.
And the other thing is they're moving to a time of no central government leadership. Military power. You know, it seemed really important to Moses. In fact, he kind of came to God with that and said, please appoint a leader. These people are sheep without a shepherd. And now Joshua's aging out. I guess the next chapter gets into that, right? When he says he's getting old. Well, okay, who's Joshua's successor? Who's the central leader? And how do you resolve issues among these disparate tribes that will inevitably grow farther and farther apart without a centralized, government? I'm trying not to get political about a party that, you know, values central control versus distributed virtue. But there's a picture here, really, of how that might work without a centralized leader, without a king, a physical earthly king, like the time of Judges.
Yep.
Yeah, I think along those same lines, you know, they're decentralizing government here, and they're trying to decide, okay, what do we need to do to remember the law and keep it and, you know, help our future generations? So they're thinking through, you know, they're not getting this passed down from one authority figure within their ranks anymore, and they made a decision. So.
And despite that there's no kind of capital of Israel, maybe the religious unity around the tabernacle would be close, but that's not where the armies are run from. You know, that's not where the taxes are all collected, you know, for all the nation and redistributed to the everybody. There's no central political place. So how do we remember that we really still all are one nation from one man with the identity of God's people? How do you do that? So maybe this chapter is part of that story that they'll always carry.
Yep. So what happens in 2 Kings 23? I gave you two verses, but in the larger context of the chapter, what is Josiah doing in that story?
He's getting rid of the high places.
Yeah, and so in verses 8 and 9, what specific kind of situation with the high places does the text address? Who was being worshipped at the high places?
Asherah pole, like the goddess Asherah is like the high places.
Yes, and if I remember correctly,
Baal.
Verse 10 refers to Molech. I don't.
Yeah. Priests of high places not go to the altar of the Lord in Jerusalem, but they ate unleavened bread among their brothers. That seems to be a reference to a hybridized worship where priests, Levites even, Levites and real Levitical priests, were conducting worship of God at the high places as part of the all the other things that were going on there. There's significant archaeological evidence for that actually in Israel. So part, in addition to just dealing with the hybridization of the worship. I think they would have found this story from Joshua 22 useful because that's kind of what Israel thinks the two and a half tribes are doing. Their point is in verses 16 to 20 is idolatry and immorality from Peor and rebellion from the story of Achan not enough? Now you want to corrupt the worship too by building this altar. And even if it's an altar to Jehovah, it's not the altar that he commanded. It's not at the tabernacle. I think they might have looked at this story and seen from Israel's history that we're only supposed to worship God where he expressly approves of and only in the approved manner. We're not doing any kind of hybrid worship, which may have been, it seems like that's what Josiah was dealing with in 2 Kings chapter 23. All good answers. I think this chapter has a lot to teach us. So I want to talk about these, I'm calling them the realities of obedience. Like I said, I made that up, but I think these things are true. Obedience takes constant thought and effort. You see that exhibited in the story. The Transjordan tribes were thinking ahead and planning for their children's spiritual lives. They took action in order to lay the foundation. It's kind of what Russ talked about in the sermon this morning, this idea of, you know, making a plan and provision for the future. You see that in the Transjordan tribes. Israel, on the other hand, was ready to kill their kinsmen in order to ensure obedience. Now, that maybe seems a little bit rash to us, but they're interested in obedience, and they're willing to do what it takes and put some effort into ensuring that. But speaking of constant thought and effort, Israel was willing to hear and consider all the facts before acting. They send a delegation of kind of the best people they had, Phinehas and leaders of the 10 tribes, to find out what was going on. They put some effort into that, some thought into who they were going to send, who would be most effective as a mediator between them and the Transjordan tribes. And so, I mean, I think the applications to our own lives are obvious, that if we're going to obey God, we're going to have to put some thought into it and some effort into it. And especially as we are considering the future and encouraging and providing for obedience in the next generation, we have to put some thought and effort into it. Another reality of disobedience that I see here is that everybody needs help sometimes. The Transjordan tribes wanted to help their descendants be faithful. They didn't just say, well, they'll figure it out. God is powerful. He can show them whatever he needs to. They wanted to help. Israel is prepared to help the Transjordan tribes obey, maybe by threat of punishment, but still ready to help. And that's good. And there are New Testament precedents for that to say, look, these are the consequences of this action that you're engaged in, and you need to repent. And Israel, of course, needed to learn some more facts to ensure their obedience. And they were wise enough to get some mediators to collect those facts and help them understand what was going on and to ask the people face to face instead of just assuming the worst or talking to somebody else who didn't really understand the situation either. And so I think that principle that everybody needs help sometimes is a good one for us to keep in mind as we consider our own obedience to God. And finally, this is a little bit trickier, but obedience can look like disobedience to those who don't have all the facts. And maybe you've been in a situation like that where you did the right thing and somebody else thought you did the wrong thing, mostly because they didn't have all the facts in hand. Meredith was telling me about a situation when before we were dating, where she had been dating somebody, and when the relationship ended, she changed her profile picture on Facebook from a picture of the two of them to a picture of her and somebody else, another guy, and somebody that she went to church with, who I think wanted them to get back together. Felt like that was just a mean thing to do, to put a picture of her and another guy on Facebook immediately after the relationship had ended. Well, it turns out it was her brother, her twin brother, right? Like, there's nothing offensive about that. There's nothing, you know, the person just didn't know. They didn't have all the facts. And so it looked worse than it actually was. And so what Israel does here is to intentionally seek out more facts, to send people to find out what's going on. To turn that around a little bit, as the person who is doing something that might look like disobedience to somebody else, and we'll dive into this in more detail in a minute, but we have to be aware that perceived disobedience can cause the ignorant to sin, and we certainly want to be careful about that. So this is not this one is just an observation that needs to inform our decision making and our thinking as we are trying to obey God. To realize that obedience can look like disobedience, and we probably would do wisely to prepare for that. I have more to say about this in a later slide, so I'm going to just kind of skip ahead. But I think there are three positions that character groups in this story find themselves in that we can put ourselves into, or find ourselves in even. And I think there are strategies for each of those in this. First one is, when we're trying to do good things, or at least things that are not wrong, that might look bad, that's the situation that the Transjordan tribes found themselves in. The second situation is when we're trying to help those who are disobedient. That's what Israel thought they were doing, right? They went to go correct them. So when we're trying to help those who are disobedient, what can we learn from that? And then third, trying to deal with behaviors that are not wrong, but they seem kind of ill-advised or bad to us. That's the sort of the reality of what Israel was facing. And so I think as we look through these this story, I think we can discern some principles that will help us in our own obedience and in our attempts to help others who are either struggling or are not doing anything wrong, but maybe it doesn't look very good. So from this chapter, what do you think the Transjordan tribes did wrong when they set up their altar as a witness? Like, what's the one thing they could have done that would have made this whole situation go away before it started?
It struck me that in their explanation, I wrote down verse 27 and maybe 34, that this is supposed to be a witness between us and you, I think it says. But it's kind of unilateral. Like,
yeah,
if we're making some kind of a joint memorial, maybe we should all be informed about it. I mean, that's the simple thing. But
right.
It is a kind of a – and now maybe their story kind of incorporated the – no, it wasn't just for us to remember. It was for you to remember, too. Maybe that got added in later. But it just seems like if it was a joint memorial, maybe the jointness could have been a little bit better.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So they say – I mean, that, in verse 28, this is their plan, that when Israel on the other side of the river says well, you're not a part of us, then we'll say, yeah, but look at this altar that we built. Well, if they don't understand what the altar means, it's just a pile of stones. It doesn't mean anything. The mistake was not informing Israel of the covenant that the altar represented, which, I mean, I feel like that's an important thing to do if you're going to make a covenant with somebody, is at least let them know they're in the covenant. But I think there's some applications there for us when we are trying to do good the Transjordan tribes were not forbidden to build a memorial. There's even a measure of precedent for it. There are other memorials that are built for similar kinds of purposes, even in the book of Joshua, within the lifetime of the people who were building this memorial. But I think their two mistakes were not thinking about what this was going to look like to the rest of Israel, and then forgetting to explain their purpose in advance. So I think maybe some applications for our use of what Paul in 1 Corinthians will call liberties, things that you are allowed to do, that you are permitted under the law. So a good thing to do would be to consider how this action looks to somebody else. Because in Paul's discussion here, in 1 Corinthians, and Russ talked about some of these principles in his lesson this morning, so I don't want to rehash it too much. But the weak brother in 1 Corinthians 8 is really just somebody who doesn't know what you know, and that's the point. They just don't understand, and so because they don't understand, you need to consider how your action looks to them. That's a good thing to do, but I think a better thing to do would be to have an explanation for how your use of this liberty is going to draw you and others closer to God. And that's why I distinguish between good and maybe not wrong things. I think there are some things, Paul says, that are fine to do. They're not wrong, but they may not be best. They may not be edifying. They may not be profitable. And that's the discussion there in 1 Corinthians chapter 8. So if we can figure out and be able to explain to somebody and maybe even proactively explain to them, I'm going to do this and I want you to understand why I'm doing it, and explain how this will draw you and others closer to God, I think that's the better thing to do. And I think if the 2.5 tribes had done this, they could have avoided all of the gathering of the army and coming across the river and all of this controversy. So I think some good applications there for us when we're trying to do good things that might look bad. We need to think about it and be able to explain why this is not just permitted, but actually good and helpful.
Hey, Mace?
Yes.
A thought that I had earlier is still that they use a symbol in my mind. They used a symbol, which is the altar, that was already a struggle for the Israelites. I mean, they had an issue with serving or worshiping or desiring to worship other gods. So to make and the scripture also said it was a great and impressive altar. So, I mean, it just looked like they were enhancing some desires that they may have had in the past. And, but, I mean, it worked out okay. But, I mean, if they had any kind of motives behind building that altar other than the ones that they shared, I mean, it could have just been a disaster.
Yeah, that's true. I think we can only assess their motives based on what's revealed in the text. We don't want to, you know, assign motives to them without those being revealed to us. And yeah. I actually think that I think they did the right. I think it was fine for them to build this altar. The mistake they made, which would have, you know, as we said, avoided all of this, would be to have explained what it meant before they built it, or just, you know, maybe to even invite them to come and participate in the building of it and say it's not for worship, and to say all the things that they said when the conflict kind of started, to say those earlier. Because, yeah, as you say, it looked pretty bad to Israel. So based on Israel's kind of response to this altar and them marching across and calling the Transjordan tribes to account, do you think there are any applications that we can draw from this story about our responsibility to correct individual Christians and or other congregations? There's some passages here. These were in your lesson. We don't have time to break into groups, which I wish we could, but I'm curious what you came up with.
Well, I put down on mine, the first thing we have to do is consider whether a crime has been committed against God, because they believe that as they marched over there that these people were sinning against God. And I think that was the bigger issue, not that they were sinning against them, but that this sin was against God. And I think that the examples they used, Peor and Achan, was very extreme examples. But it was like, because they kept saying, and the whole congregation suffered because of what they did. So I think it's different when somebody's sinning against themselves, and maybe the sin is going to stay kind of isolated, than to think that you're sinning against God and then everybody else going to suffer because of what you did.
Yeah, I don't know how different it is. I mean, I think most sins that we commit end up affecting somebody some way or another. But I think you're exactly right about the process. We are commanded to correct brethren who are erring, Galatians 6:1 and other places. But as Teresa pointed out, we have to investigate everything fully before we take action. I've always found it interesting in Acts 5 when Peter is confronting Ananias and Sapphira. In verse 8, Sapphira comes in. She doesn't know what's happened to Ananias. And Peter asks her the same question again. And, you know, we often make the point, well, he's just trying to make sure that she's complicit in it. I think that's right. But. You know, you want to make sure. You want to take the time and not assume that, well, if her husband did it, then she was involved in it too. And so he takes the time to ask her what happened, ask her to recount it in her own words, and then the condemnation that is issued is based on that, not on the conversation with her husband that had happened previously. We also have a God-given discipline process when we are dealing with individuals. In Matthew chapter 18, Jesus says you go to them, you talk to them. If they won't listen, you take witnesses. If they still won't listen, then you take it before the whole congregation. And that's a process that I think we can follow. And to kind of pull in some of the themes from our study, we have to be strong and courageous in doing that. And confronting people who are in sin is not, it's not fun. It's not easy. It's not something that any of us would willingly do. And so it's going to take some strength and courage and willingness to do hard things. But it's easy to just get ourselves, if we find ourselves having to confront someone, to get fired up to do the hard thing and then forget to be gentle and meek as we do it. And so I think that's an important balance. And I think sending the delegation, well, with Phinehas specifically, who has a history of zeal for obedience to God, but is also, you know, wise enough to to do things the right way was a good choice. There is also a precedent for what you might call intercongregational restoration. Now, I want to be very clear about this. There is no authority in the Scripture for one congregation or a group of congregations to quarantine or withdraw from or mark congregations or even members of other congregations. So that's not what we're talking about here. What I'm talking about is what happens in Acts 15, where there are teachers who are teaching that you have to become a Jew in order to be saved under the new covenant. And the congregation in Antioch hears this from people who claim to have come from Jerusalem, from the congregation there. And so, because there's a negative impact of this false teaching, there's confusion, and there are people, you know, questioning the gospel that they believed, they send a delegation in verse 2 of Acts 15 to Jerusalem. They see what's going on there. Is this really what they're teaching, or did we, you know, misunderstand this? Verses 4 and 5. And if it's proclaim the truth, to say, look, this is the reality, this is what the gospel actually says, then we would do that. And that happens in verses 6 and following as the what we call the conference in Jerusalem gets underway. Now, so that I think is a precedent for a way that a congregation could maybe help another congregation stay on track. But we also have to respect congregational autonomy in our zeal for the truth. We are not ruling over another congregation. We are not making decisions for them about what they will believe or practice. We have to respect that congregational autonomy. And our goal, of course, is to seek restoration of the erring, and not victory in an argument. So I wish we had time to talk about this one more, but I'm gonna keep moving. But I think when we are in the situation that Israel thought they were in, of somebody's disobeyed God and I've got to deal with that, it's my responsibility to deal with it, I think these are the principles that we need to follow. That's the situation Israel thought they were in. But of course, it wasn't really, and so that kind of I'm getting ahead of myself. So when we go to correct or discipline someone, these need to be our goals: to encourage obedience, but not to force it. We can't force someone to obey as much as we would like to try to sometimes. But we also want to protect ourselves and others against disobedience and its consequences. That's part of why we are correcting them, and that's the point that that Phinehas makes in Joshua chapter 22. That, like, if you disobey, we're all going to suffer as a result of that. He also uses this phrase at the end of the chapter that we know that the Lord is in our midst. We know that Jehovah is in our midst. I think that needs to be a goal, that we want to demonstrate that. We want to demonstrate covenant faithfulness on both sides. And in 1 John, he highlights this in chapter 3, verse 24, when he says that the one who keeps his commandments abides in him and he in him. We know by this that he abides in us by the Spirit whom he has given us. As we are being corrected and walking more in accordance with his will, we are demonstrating that God is among us, that we are in fellowship with him and he with us. We also want to encourage obedience in others who observe the correction process. In Acts 5, after Ananias and Sapphira are punished, fear fell on the church, and it also affected those who were outside. They respected them, and in verse 14, many more people were added to their number. And so that action, that discipline there, resulted in obedience among others who observed it. And then finally, we also want to restore the relationship with God while maintaining the human relationship, if that's at all possible. We don't want to discourage the people that we are correcting. This is the instruction to fathers about don't discourage your children as you are trying to discipline them, and that's something that we need to be careful about. doing it. And I think we see that in action in the gentle way in which Israel approached the Transjordan tribes. Okay, these are the things that Israel was trying to do by correcting the 2.5 tribes. Of course, in reality, they didn't need to do any of this. And that leads to our third point, which is about these offensive altars, is what I'm calling them. And so this question was in your lesson. So what are some things you see people do that you know are not wrong and perhaps are even beneficial to them, but that make you uncomfortable somehow? And then based on this story, create a plan for dealing with one of these situations. Now, I know that what I've just described in this question is not parallel exactly to what's going on in Joshua 22, because they actually thought the tribes had sinned. They were convinced that it was wrong, and they were ready to punish them for it. I know it's not parallel. Bear with me for a second. I'll explain the connection. I'm not going to force anybody to confess something that other people do that bothers you. If you want to tell me about it later, that's fine, but you don't have to. I'll tell you one of mine. I sometimes have a problem with the lyrics of hymns that people like. I think some of them are a little bit shallow. I think some of them are focused on us as people rather than focused on God. They're focused on what we want or what we like rather than what God has asked for and how worship is sort of described in the Bible. And some songs we sing actually just contain doctrinal errors, and it's just there, you know, and that bothers me. And I know that the people who are singing these songs are not doing it like out of rebellion. It makes me uncomfortable, and I need to figure out how to deal with that. And so I think some principles that we can follow is, first of all, to assume that you don't know all the facts. You got to go investigate. Maybe these people don't know what kind of hymns they're singing. Maybe they don't know about the doctrinal errors in the songs that they're singing. And so I need to go figure out what's going on and ask them. Second, I need to assume that I'm the weaker brother or sister. This is the language from Romans. But remember the difference between the weaker brother and sister is just about knowledge. So if I assume that I'm the weaker brother, that means there's some truth or fact that I don't fully understand, and I can go figure that out. I can investigate it and come to know that. And so I need to assume that this thing that I think of as wrong or ill-advised or whatever might be a valid use of liberty, and it might even be a blessing to the person who is engaged in it. But I don't know that because there's some truth or fact that I don't fully understand. As the weaker brother or sister, my responsibility is to go investigate, to learn facts, so that I can be fully informed to understand the situation. If confrontation is necessary, I need to take other wiser people with me, and make sure that I have somebody else there to sort of make sure that I don't get angry or fly off the handle, to make sure that I'm phrasing my questions in a way that is most helpful, to make sure that I'm phrasing them as questions and not accusations, things like that. I think that's this is the principle of taking two or three witnesses with you that Jesus gave us, and I think it's a good application for us as well. And we need to seek everyone's spiritual growth, not victory. And this is one thing that assuming that I'm the weaker brother or sister helps with, is that I am consciously going into this discussion looking to grow in my knowledge. And that will help me from – that will help prevent me from just saying, well, I know what's right and wrong, and I'm going to hit you over the head with it. We're not trying to win. There is no winning. We're trying to grow together. I'm trying to grow, and the person that I'm talking to is trying to grow. I need to have that as my primary goal and not be concerned about winning the argument or having the gotcha passage that proves they're wrong or whatever. And then finally, I need to – and this is kind of a – well, I need to assume that the facts in one case don't necessarily apply in another case, even if it's identical. So, Phineas says, well, remember Achan and remember Peor, And that's the model that we're operating on. Well, it turns out that's not the model that really applied best here. And so they were ready. They said, okay, good. That model doesn't apply. Let's get a new model where we're all united in our obedience to God. And so we need to assume that the facts in one case don't necessarily apply in another, even if the case appears identical on first inspection. So this is the reality of what Israel faced, that they were trying to deal with behaviors that were not wrong, but they, as it turned out, they didn't know that at the time, but it definitely seemed bad to them in the beginning. So here's where this case of of things that are, you know, are not wrong, but that just kind of bother you a little bit. Here's why I phrased the question in that way. All of these tactics, skills, whatever you want to call them, apply when you know something isn't wrong, you just are uncomfortable with it, right? They also apply when something is wrong, when there is sin. You still have to do all of these things. But most of us are not confronted every single day with a different offensive altar of something that actually is wrong. So how do we learn these skills? How do we practice them? Well, I think the way we practice them is by applying them in situations where it's just a matter of conscience or it's just a matter of opinion or something like that. We take these principles and we apply them to things like the song choices that people like. And we practice doing these things. We make them a part of our character, that we always look for more information and we assume we're the weaker brother or sister, where we seek everybody's spiritual growth. We do those in easy cases, like matters of opinion, and that way they're ingrained into our character when we actually have to deal with somebody who is in sin. And so I know it's not parallel, but I think it's a good you could think of it as a vaccine, right? It's a weakened form of the situation. You're gonna learn, develop the skills, the antibodies, if you will, so that when you encounter the real thing full strength, you'll be ready for it. And I think that's one of the things that this chapter is really helpful in helping us to see. I've heard sermons from, you know, Romans 8 and 1 Corinthians 8 and 10 about using liberties and about and from Matthew 18 about confronting people who are in sin, about discipline. I've never heard anybody use Joshua 22 as an illustration of that, and I think that it's a good one. So all of you guys that preach occasionally, if you're going to preach a sermon on that, maybe at least reference Joshua 22. I think it might even preach from the chapter and then bring in the New Testament applications. I really like this chapter. I really like the messages that it has for us, for our own spiritual growth, and also for helping other people to walk in fellowship with God. I've gone long again. Nobody's surprised at this point, but we've got a couple of minutes left if anybody has a question or something else that you saw in this chapter.
I have just a quick question. That is, where's Joshua in all this?
I had that question too. I don't know.
Maybe it's leading up to this next chapter where he's kind of out of the picture. I've
right.
said that really, Joshua, I've said this before, I think in his class, I don't remember where I read it, but that Joshua was really more of a military leader, but not really so much of a lawgiver, politician, you know, squabble settler kind of.
Yep, that may be. There in Judges, there's the case, now I forget the chapter, Dad, you would remember this, where they go to punish the Benjamites for the, this chapter 20. Who is leading that? Do you remember? Remember who leads that expedition?
Phinehas comes up, which suggests the earlier date.
Yeah, so that seems like that story actually belongs way earlier in Israel's history. So I think that may support your point that Phinehas, kind of as the high priest, as he probably should be, is taking some responsibility for the spiritual part of Israel's life. Yeah. But I don't really know where Joshua is. All right. Well, I'll let everybody go so you can get on the service. If you've got questions for the review session, lesson 13, I've got some already, which is great. If you have more, send them to me, and I will try to answer them. All right. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you, Mason.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mason.